Welcome to the South Carolina State Library's podcast, Library Voices SC. I'm Curtis Rogers, Communications Director, and today I'm pleased to have with us in our studio Kimberly J. Sims. Kimberly's literary voice is rooted in the Southern tradition of storytelling, informed by her British and Southern lineage. She is an award-winning poet and was the 2016 Carl Sandburg National Historic Site, say that really fast, writer in residence. In her debut book of poems, Lindy Lee, Songs on Mill Hill, Kimberly chronicles the lives of textile workers in the Piedmont, and that's the Piedmont of South Carolina, with historical accuracy and imaginative insight. These are poems of sorrow, joy, and redemption that linger in the heart. She is a Pushcart Prize nominee, and her work is included in the South Carolina Poetry Archives at Furman University. And you can learn more about Kimberly at KimberlyJSims.com, and we will have that link listed here on our website. So thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here. It's a beautiful day in Columbia today.
I know, and we're glad to have you. I'm glad you were in town so that you could come and join us. Tell us a little bit about your poetry history. How did you get interested in poetry, and what kind of other things have you written?
Well, I started, I think, like many people, writing poetry in school. In middle school, I just found that it seemed like words would kind of follow me around until I wrote them down. And then when I was in high school, I began attending open mic poetry events. Oh. And that was really amazing because it connected me with kind of the next generation and older generation of poets. Mm-hmm. And I was able to really learn a lot from the other poets that I met at open mics. And then, of course, I went to college and was able to take some poetry classes and continue to find community at poetry events with other poets, which is something that's really important to me. Mm-hmm. And I've been very lucky that I have always been able to find great homes for my poetry, too. I had my first poem published when I was 19.
Oh, wow.
In a Chicago magazine. And I got paid a big $3.85, and I knew that I was going to make a lot in the poetry field.
That's something that might be the thing that, you know, keeps you going. You mentioned going to open mics. Did you have a teacher or someone who inspired you or asked you to participate in something like
no,
that?
No, it was, I don't even know how I found out about it. I may have seen, this is back before Facebook, so I think I saw a flyer on the street, and I had these poems, and I thought, oh, my gosh. And I convinced a friend to go with me. Mm-hmm. And we kind of showed up, and it was this very kind of bohemian mm-hmm. kind of setting. And there were some musicians there and people playing bongos. And, and I was like 17. I was like, well, this is so amazing. Uh-huh. And I was hooked.
Okay.
I was hooked. So.
Very cool. Was it was slam poetry in then, or was that
it
something?
Was, slam poetry was just getting started in the late 80s,
okay.
and then really in the 90s is when slam started to get kind of a little bit more of a foothold. So this was kind of in the early 90s. I was doing open mics, and I ended up in Charleston at what I thought was going to be open mic one day that mm-hmm. turned out to be a poetry slam when I was pretty young, and because of that did end up doing a little bit of poetry slam in my 20s. Mm-hmm. I actually ran the first poetry slam in South Carolina was in Charleston.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, a number of years ago.
Very
so that
neat.
Was pretty fun.
Also, there's something called Poetry Out Loud, which I think the State Arts Commission manages.
Yes.
Is that anything you've been
yes.
involved with?
I love Poetry Out Loud. And congratulations, the winner for the National Poetry Out Loud contest is from South Carolina this year.
I didn't realize that.
Yes,
wonderful.
Which is so exciting. She's from Charleston. And I have been a judge for the upstate region for the past 3 years with mm-hmm. Poetry Out Loud. Mm-hmm. So I just love that program, just the way it encourages young people to memorize well-known poetry and then to perform that poetry out loud.
Mm-hmm.
It just really celebrates poetry and gets kids involved in poetry, and also I think creates this base for people that may not even write themselves. Like mm-hmm. you don't have to be a writer to participate in Poetry Out Loud. You just have to love poetry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that's something we need more of, is people that just love poetry and are reading and poetry fans. And Poetry Out Loud is a great way for people to express their love for poetry and reading.
Definitely. One of the things that piqued my interest in your bio was your Furman connection, and I personally think that's one of the most beautiful campuses that I've ever been on.
I love Furman.
How did it come about that your poetry is in the poetry archives there?
Well, I was very lucky that I actually attended Furman University, and I was able to study under the two poets that were there at that time, which is William R. Nelson and Gilbert Allen, who were huge influences on my own poetry. Mm-hmm. And a number of years after I left Furman, 96 Press approached me to include 15 of my poems in a book called Quintet, which featured five upstate poets.
Okay.
And so I was just so excited to have my poems included in that, and then as part of that also had my work included in the Poetry Archive, which was very new at that time. Mm-hmm. They acquired one of my early chapbooks, as well as in the Quintet is also in that library. But I'm a Furman alumni, mm-hmm. so I obviously have a big love for Furman. And I'm from Greenville, South Carolina as well. So okay. Furman is just does a great job of being involved in the community in Greenville, South Carolina.
Very cool. So. And you mentioned Gil Allen. I was on the board of the South Carolina Academy of Authors when he was inducted to the
He's
Academy.
He's fabulous.
He really is. And I loved hearing his poetry.
And his sense of humor is just wonderful.
Yeah.
And he's very generous with his time and with mentoring other young poets, mm-hmm. in addition to being a wonderful poet and short story mm-hmm. writer himself. Mm-hmm. So I have big kudos for Gil Allen.
That's great. That's great. Well, so you recently joined us to do a book talk with our Speaker at the Center program,
yes.
which is our readsc.org, our South Carolina Center for the Book, which is an affiliate of the Library of Congress Center for the Book. And so it was really great to have you here in Columbia. So thanks for coming all the way back to talk to me.
You.
But the book that you talked about is Lindy Lee, Songs on Mill Hill. And how did tell us about that book. How did it come about?
Well, basically, this is a book that brings together history, poetry, and photography. I've always been a big history buff, even from when I was in high school. I just love history. I had a history teacher that I think all history teachers do this great job of really just being wonderful storytellers. So when I was in high school, history was definitely my favorite subject. And when I began working on my master's degree at Clemson University, I had written one poem about the textile mills called Last Day at the Mill. I had written it. I was teaching a workshop for women, and I was helping women to write poems about their family stories and had everyone bring in some photographs. And I brought in a photograph of a woman sitting at a textile mill machine and ended mm-hmm. up writing this poem. And the poem ended up getting published in the Millennium Sampler of South Carolina Poetry and was very well received. And I thought, I really enjoyed writing about the textile mills. I think I want to write more of those poems. And at the time, I was looking for a book topic for my thesis to do my master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing some research, and I think I went down the rabbit hole of the textile mill history.
Mm-hmm.
I have family members that worked in the mill, so I knew I had kind of this basic understanding.
Sure.
You know, going through school in Greenville, South Carolina, you know, it's the textile capital of the world.
It's a huge part of South Carolina's history.
It's a huge part. I mean, it's just around you all the time mm-hmm. here. So I did not have to go far to realize I already did know some about the textile mills. And then I began talking to people, but also reading books. I visited several libraries, because libraries not only have current books, but I was able to go on microfiche and look up mm-hmm. historical newspapers mm-hmm. right in my hometown library. I could mm-hmm. go and read newspapers from the 20s and 30s and look at the different South Carolina archives for mm-hmm. historical information about the textile mills.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, I did spend a lot of time in libraries.
Yay, we love to hear that.
while I was researching the book, I was at the Furman Library, the Clemson Library, the different South Carolina libraries,
mm-hmm.
and then all those great online resources that libraries provide. There's a lot of great libraries in North Carolina, too, that have mm-hmm. a lot of great resources.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of just took in all this textile mill information, and then this kind of character started to form, because what I found was that the story the stories that I already knew from Greenville's history were repeated, and there were patterns of stories that I found all across Western Georgia, Western North and South Carolina, and mm-hmm. Western North Carolina. And so I really ended up creating a character who would be like an archetype that would represent all the women that worked in the textile mills.
Hmm.
I really became particularly interested in the early textile mill era between 1890 and about 1940.
Okay.
So most of the poems in the book are actually set in the 1920s mm-hmm. and 1930s. And what I kind of found is once I had all this kind of history in my head, this kind of voice just emerged, and I was able to write the poems as a series of persona poems.
Okay.
So the book actually has a story arc as it follows mm-hmm. this teenage girl from her first days in the mill when she's about 10
mm-hmm.
As she gets older and falls in love and has some different life experiences through to when she's a mother herself.
Hmm.
So even though it's a book of poetry and it's a book of history poetry, this also has a story
hmm.
of a young girl living in a kind of hard scrabble mill town and what that life would have been like.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You mentioned also photography. How mm-hmm. does photography play a part in this?
Well, when I was doing my research, I came across the photography of Lewis Hine. And Lewis Hine was a photographer that was hired by the federal government to go around and photograph the children that were working in the textile mills. It was during the time that they were trying to make a law against child labor.
Oh, okay.
And so he would go to different mills under the guise of different, like sometimes he would tell people he was a Bible salesman and that he was giving away Bibles, but he needed to take pictures of the kids holding the Bibles.
Really?
Or sometimes he would say he was from the fire marshal and he was there to, he had all these kind of
any way to sneak in.
Way that he would sneak into these mills to get the photographs of children. And then also sometimes he would just end up taking pictures of the kids actually in the mill villages or right before they went into work or right after they came out of work.
Hmm.
And so I had already written a lot of the poems when I found the photography. But just being able to put a face to mm-hmm. the stories,
mm-hmm.
And the faces of these children in the book are, these pictures are from, you know, Newberry, South Carolina, mm-hmm. and the upstate, mm-hmm. and Georgia and North Carolina. So these are, you know, actual children
sure.
that actually worked in the mills. And a lot of people told me that having, because there's about maybe 15, I mean, there's quite a lot of photographs mm-hmm. in there that having the photograph to go along with the poem
mm-hmm.
really helps to kind of bring the poem alive.
Definitely. Was there an actual Lindy Lee?
There was not an actual Lindy Lee, but I will say my grandmother's name is Lee.
Okay.
And so it's definitely a little bit of a nod to her.
Mm-hmm.
However, with this book, I did not want it to make a book about my personal family. I wanted mm-hmm. it to be more representative of women during this time period. When you're in the early textile era, only 37% of the workers were men. The rest were women and
really?
Children. And most people, when they think of work before the 1960s, they kind of assume it's all men.
Mm-hmm.
But that absolutely was not the case. It was mostly women and children.
Hmm.
Most of the supervisors were men, but the majority of the workers were women. And kids as young as 6 or 8
really?
Would be actually working in the mill, sweeping and changing mm-hmm. bobbins and mm-hmm. things like that. The kids would probably only work 6 to 8 hours a day, where the parents would work 12 hours a day.
Wow.
But they were there, mom and daughters working mm-hmm. side by side, whole families working together in the mill.
Mm.
And it was a different era back then.
Oh, yeah, and
it
I know exactly what you talk about when you have the word mill hill in the title. Because
oh, yeah.
That, you know, that's, I grew up part of my life in Union, South Carolina,
yes.
and so there's the mill hill.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know exactly what it is.
And every town has several or one textile mill villages. You know, mm-hmm. cotton was king.
Mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
know, the textile mills ran not only the factory,
mm-hmm.
but also, as you know, the mill store and the post office and the church.
Oh, yeah.
And one thing I think that's a little bit different about the Southern Industrial Revolution is the fact that it was a rural revolution. pollution. Mm-hmm. So up north, you have people that are coming out of the countryside and moving into cities. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the south, as folks came from sharecropping or farming, they actually stayed in the countryside and mm-hmm. the mills came to them. Mm-hmm. So you find a lot of textile mills in very kind of isolated, in yes. the middle of nowhere
exactly.
locations.
Like in Monarch. In,
yes.
in Union County,
yes.
you know, there's Monarch Mills.
Yep, and also, too, people were still farming while they worked in the mills. They brought their goats and their chickens and their hogs with them, and they actually still growed most of their food while they're working 12 hours a day. And part of what they had to live in the textile mill village, they were also given a small plot of land on mm. which they could farm. Mm-hmm. And so one of the ways that people survived during the early textile era is by working together. Mm. And I have such admiration for the tightness of the communities. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, one family might grow beans and another family might grow corn, and then they would all can together mm-hmm. and share those resources. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll kill my hog this week and next week we'll kill your hog. And everybody would kind of work together.
Like a real community.
Like a real community. they were bonded, and they would give, you know, everybody the last, you know, the last can of beans in their pantry. They would share down to the very last thing that they had. And I think today, people are still very generous mm-hmm. In mm-hmm. this area, and it came out of that sense of community and sharing with each other that developed during that textile era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Well, I would love for you
Great.
To maybe read a selection
yes.
or two.
Yeah, I would love to.
I would love to hear some.
I think I'm actually going to start with a baseball poem.
Okay.
One of the things that was such an important part of the textile era was baseball. Every textile mill had its own baseball team.
Really?
So the owners of textile mills were also the owners of baseball teams, and they were very, very proud of their baseball teams. And they had really amazing players. And actually, there was a lot of people that worked or played in the textile league that were offered positions in minor leagues and did not take them.
Wow.
Because they could actually make more money at these kind of cushy jobs the textile mill owner would give them
okay.
for being a great baseball player.
Ah, that's interesting.
So they would be working for the textile mill, which probably involved a lot of practicing baseball, mm-hmm. and then they would play, you know, play the games.
Wow, that's interesting. And I didn't realize that about.
And there's actually, I think it's the Textile League Hall of Fame, and
okay.
they are still there are still players that are being inducted into that Hall of Fame
really?
Today, and it's still around.
That's amazing.
I mean, it was huge. Because it was really the main form of entertainment that people had, mm-hmm. you know, particularly when you're talking 1920, 1930,
yeah,
1940.
Yeah, when you don't have TV, you don't have the internet, you don't have all these other
no,
distractions.
No, you have baseball, and you don't have to have a lot of equipment to play baseball.
Right.
And I will say this, even today, I live in Slater, Marietta. Little League is a serious thing in the small towns
oh, sure.
of South Carolina, mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. that love of baseball has definitely carried through
yeah.
from that textile era. So
yeah.
baseball is a serious thing here in
oh,
South
yeah.
Carolina. So let me
Certainly.
Read the poem, I guess.
Yes, please do.
So this is called Slice. He takes second base the way a train burns a grade, all heft and pent speed, jolting the baseman into the chalk clay. The crowd in the painted pine grandstand roars like a room of power looms each time he skins the cowhide off, launching rockets past outfielders into muddy pastures. Even at 15, a bruiser of a boy, a strapping right-hander from a deep bench of cotton mill boys who got their start with bare feet, scrambling across red clay diamonds, exploding rag balls with picker sticks. He was cross-cut and rough, a burly hurler, a stout slugger who made more rolling cotton and playing textile ball than he could in the minor league. Lady Luck never turned him to the top, but his shifts were light, his store credit vast, a slice with an eternal bat and ball at his palm.
Wow, that's really powerful. And that one phrase I picked out was store credit. And that, you know, that's true, because that back then, during the time where they were working, they would get credits to be able to, you know, purchase
Absolutely.
Stuff at the mill store.
I mean, when we say cotton's king, they were not even they were not even using U.S. currency.
Mm-hmm.
They would pay the workers even in their own coins mm-hmm. or in what they would call script.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was not really until the 40s that people were really actually getting paid at all. Most
wow.
of the workers never, ever saw a paycheck. They would work 12 hours a day, but by the time they deducted rent, electricity, and the few staples like cornbread or flour that they had gotten at the mill store, they would have what's called a balance due. They would actually owe money to the store.
Jeez.
So because of this, you know, you couldn't really just go to another mill because
mm-hmm.
you didn't have any cash
mm-hmm,
with
mm-hmm.
which to get somewhere else. So it made it very difficult for the workers.
You were a little indentured.
You were an indentured servant, exactly. I mean, of course, that changed. You know, working the textile mill was a great job in the 50s and 60s. There
mm-hmm.
was definitely a golden age.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're looking at the early textile era, it was a very tough
mm-hmm.
life to live.
Oh, yeah.
And people worked very, very hard.
Mm-hmm.
And just lived at basically a subsistence level, I would
mm-hmm.
say.
Mm-hmm. I actually am also a coin collector, and I happen to have a token from a Spartanburg mill.
Oh, wow.
That I have in my collection.
That's just an amazing
piece of history.
It's so interesting. I mean, the whole thing is just fascinating to me.
It is.
Do you want me to read another one?
Yes, please
okay,
do.
Okay, great. One of the things that was interesting, too, about the textile mills is that when you're coming from a life of agriculture and a very kind of quiet, silent life,
mm-hmm.
and then you come into this textile mill town that's very loud because
mm-hmm.
the textile mills ran 24 hours a day.
Wow.
They were water-powered, so if the river was down, occasionally the textile mill would come to a stop
mm-hmm.
Until it rained again, or there might be, they called them slowdowns.
Mm-hmm.
But the sound of the textile mill was around you even when you were not at work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So this poem is called Daddy's Silence, and it's set in 1918.
Okay.
Silence is a pause between shifts. A Sunday dawn. It ain't a commodity, but it's rarer than gold. Farmers got a sense about snakes. They hear the tremor of the grass, the flight zither. But here the looms are so stretched out, they shriek and jerk like sinners in a circle of fire. I know the sound of moss wings. I've heard the first cricket of spring. A lifetime back, I held the clarity of silence.
Wow, that's really deep.
I was, you know, just thinking about that big change of going from an agricultural lifestyle
mm-hmm.
into this industrial lifestyle
mm-hmm.
And all the changes that would just mean to your environment. I would think I'd like to do another kind of poem that deals this concept of the environment. One of the things I actually went and did a number of site visits to textile mills.
Okay.
And in some ways, textile mills were very green in the fact that in the early textile era, they used hydroelectric power.
Mm-hmm.
They used natural sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot speak to what they were pouring into those rivers. However,
right.
however, there were some things that they were doing really well. But as different fabrics began to change and they wanted to create a climatized environment within the mill, they actually bricked up the windows in many textile mills.
Oh,
and some
okay.
people, when they see an old textile mill, they assume the windows were bricked up after the mill closed,
right.
But the windows were actually mainly bricked up in the 1960s.
Okay.
And sometimes even earlier than that, just depending on what they were manufacturing in that particular
mm-hmm.
plant.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I thought about was if I had been working in a mill for a long time with natural sunlight, and then one day I came to work and all the windows were bricked up, I think I would find that upsetting to
mm-hmm.
have that change to my landscape.
Definitely.
And so this poem is called Blue Panes, and it's just about the feelings of Lindy Lee, my main character, as she moves into this fluorescent environment from this natural light environment.
Okay.
Blue panes. Indigo, cobalt, azure. Protection from the evil eye or wandering ghouls. Cool icy streams. The color of heaven. Jesus's robes. hyacinth blooms. How he's loved those windows. 20 years those blue eyes met mine, a window to the soul. Mr. Stevenson sent the boys up on ladders, smashing, laughing with each rain of blue tears. Blue tick, blue bird, blueberry. Shards settled in the grass and shone in the streaming sun like a thousand eyes. Who knew mortar could be spread so fast? By day end, we stood in the fluorescent lights, surrounded on all sides by endless brick. But the debris called to us like jewels to crows. We couldn't help but pick up the shards, filling our aprons with textured glass, then stringing our porches with their blue song.
Wow, that one really spoke to me. You have so many references of different kinds of blue, and you know, there's all the different kinds of shades in the sky, and so blue no more, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like no more seeing the sky while you're at work.
Right. And also too, that it was interesting to me that I didn't realize that the windows were tinted. They actually had blue windows sometimes, or green, because it would help to filter some of the heat out of the light as it came through the windows.
Wow.
So when I actually went to a site, I found the glass. I found pieces of the glass, like in around the textile mills.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
It was not, I was expecting clear glass, and here was this really thick, textured blue glass.
Really?
And I was like, and that's something about a site, you can't get that in a book sometimes.
Right, yeah, exactly, exactly. That's fascinating. One of the other phrases was Jesus's robes, and religion, you know, was a huge part of everything with the mill community.
Absolutely, you know. And you always had, you know, usually you had two churches in every mill village, the Methodist Church and the Baptist Church, and usually at least one of those preachers would be on the payroll for the mill.
Ah.
And I've read stories that if you ask them in the mill village, do they go to church, everyone would say, yes, we go to church.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of those people did not actually go to church, or maybe started to kind of meet privately because they did feel like, you know, they would prefer to maybe not have a preacher that's also on the payroll of the
right.
textile mill, because
mm-hmm.
then you're getting this message of, I think, being yeah. a good worker
mm-hmm.
as the
mm-hmm.
main message,
sure.
I think, in some of those places.
Exactly.
But yeah, religion was a huge, huge part, and an important part, because people had a lot of needs, and also it created another opportunity for community building and community events.
Definitely. Well, would you like to read one more? Is there one
yeah,
more that you have?
I think I would like to do one more.
And by the way, if people go to your website, and it's is it KimberlySims.com?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they can purchase your book that way, or
they
through
can.
Amazon, I assume?
It is available in all the big online retailers, but also in your local independent bookstore
mm-hmm.
as well.
And you can probably also check it out from your library.
You can probably check it out from your library as well. But also on my website, I will personally sign it to you if you do want to pick one up that
All
way.
Right.
And there also is an audiobook version, a companion that
okay.
goes with the book, with me reading about 10 of the poems.
Okay.
And then there's some videos and some different resources online as well.
Okay, great.
I'm going to finish with a poem called We Walk on the Moon. And this is a poem that's set in the 1960s. And when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, the cloth that he wore in they had like an inner suit.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually made in South Carolina.
Really? I did not
yes.
know that.
South Carolina makes very high-tech cloth.
Wow.
So when we think of textiles, we may just think of like shirts and underwear and socks.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, our troops today in the field are wearing a lot of things that are made in South Carolina and made in textile factories today. But in the 60s, part of the suit that the astronauts wore was actually made in South Carolina.
That's crazy. I have never heard that before.
Which is just, I think, exciting.
That is neat.
And so to me, I just thought, here you have these folks that have worked, they work so hard,
mm-hmm.
and to have something that they have created end up on the moon
mm-hmm.
is just amazing.
It is.
So this is called We Walk on the Moon. And also I'm kind of playing with the idea that TV was still pretty new at this time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, not everyone had a TV. You'd have to kind of go, everyone kind of went over
right.
to the one person on the street that had the TV's house to watch.
Uh-huh.
We walk on the moon. The air hung electric on our stooped shoulders. Jerome picked mandolin over foreign TV voices. We all counted down, held our breath, sighed it out, a collective heave. Neil Armstrong walking with our fingerprints on his Teflon-coated thread suit. Standing shoulder to shoulder on the porch, mesmerized by the RCA herder, we melded together into Teflon with dusty regolith below our feet, our heads light with triumph. The cold moon air brushed against us, sending stars across our arms, cotton cartwheeled over swimming oceans, a million pinpricks in dark fabric swallowed us in our lifetime of long textile shifts, transforming our work-worn hands into things that mattered as we stood on the moon in the Earth's shifting brightness.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
And I love that connection. I've never heard that that fabric used inside the spacesuits
yes.
was produced in South Carolina.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, South Carolina does. I mean, textile mills make some amazing, amazing mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. So it has really been a joy to me to really learn about all the things we have to be proud of
sure.
as South Carolinians, the things that the textile mills produced. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those were great jobs, particularly in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. People mm-hmm. went to work every day and felt proud of what
sure,
they did.
Sure, yeah.
So, I mean, the book is definitely addressing some of the hardships of the early textile era, but also mm-hmm. celebrating the strength of the community and the strength of the accomplishments that those workers made, too.
Very cool. On another note, since this is Library Voices podcast, what's your, and you've already talked a little bit about your connection with having used libraries and did a lot of research. Any other library stories, or did you grow up always using a library?
I did. Yeah. I grew up in Greenville, and I remember in downtown Greenville, we had that wonderful library that's got the giant earth in the middle of it.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
So, I mean, Greenville has a fabulous library. But also, I'm a big reader, so I always enjoy the excitement of what new book you're going to get at the library. Mm-hmm. But even as an author now, I've been having so much fun traveling to different libraries in the state and meeting with people about my book and talking to former textile mill workers mm-hmm. and other community members and just kind of having these little informal talks where I read some poems and we just chat about the history and answer questions and just have a lot of fun mm-hmm. and kind of hanging out. Mm-hmm. So I definitely enjoy the libraries of South Carolina and all the wonderful programming that they put on for their small communities.
And speaking of programming, I'm sure you're available to go talk at a lot of different libraries.
I am. And I'm actually on the Speakers Bureau for the South Carolina Humanities Council.
Oh, wonderful.
So people can also apply to that to get funding from me to come and speak in their community as well.
Wonderful.
And they send me to all kinds of wonderful places, and I have lots of fun history mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Poetry talks, which I love getting together and just talking with people about history.
Sure.
So it's a lot of fun for me.
And South Carolina certainly is rich in history.
Very rich indeed.
Well, what kind of special projects do you have coming up maybe in the coming months? Or?
Well, I'm still continuing. I usually have several different book events every month. And if you go on my website, you can definitely see when I'm going to be in your area. I'll be at the Georgia Center for the Book at the end of this month in May.
Okay.
And then, of course, various book festivals and things like that. And then also I'm going to be having some teen programming in the fall. I do still work with teenagers and helping them to develop their own writing skills mm-hmm. And performing their poetry. So definitely get me on Facebook or Instagram so you can keep up with all those types of events.
Great. Perfect. We'll definitely check those out. And we've got those links on our podcast website so people can find out more. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's been a good time.
And thank you to our listeners. You can find Library Voices SC on Podbean, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio, or add us on your favorite podcast app. Our podcast website address is librarycast.podbean.com. We love hearing from our listeners, so please send us your comments and suggestions for future topics. Library Voices SC is the official podcast of the South Carolina State Library. Until next time, this is Curtis Rogers. Thanks for listening.